gone. We strive at home.
Gone.
I ride on chrome.
Y'all don't want no pride from me. What you rappers could get is a job for me. Maybe you could be my intern. An intern, I'll show you how I cook up summer in the winter. Aaron love the raw dog, when will he learn?
Okay, so I'm here with Ross Perlin, who is most recently the author of Internation. Ross, how are you doing?
I'm a little bit disoriented, having gotten off the plane from China about 24 hours ago, but happy to be here.
You didn't encounter any interns along the way, or
no interns on my particular flight that I know of.
None that you know of.
But there probably were a few there in the back the back of the plane.
Got it. Well, I wanted to first of all start with the economic thrust of where interns have come from. In 1964, Gary Becker, member of the Chicago School of Economics, winner of the Nobel Prize, he comes up with something called human capital theory. And this is meant to be a reflection of the investment return on high school and college education. Becker's original concern, of course, is with higher wages. And he was roundly disparaged initially at the time. But of course, during the Reagan era, some people take Becker's ideas and say, hey, well, we can actually use this to apply the ongoing divestment of education and training, and suddenly this has an impact on intern culture. So first off, I'm curious to what degree economists and businesses have interpreted Becker's idea for a more humane and paid internship model, and how have the economic booms of the 1990s and the present, you know, the ongoing aftermath of the recession, how have these contributed to the intern culture?
Well, there's a very popular notion of internships as an investment.
Yes.
That's out there. But there are two sides to that coin. On the side of humane paid internships, the idea is the investment is made by the employer. Investment is made by the company in a potential employee. So you're paying somebody from the get-go, even though in the first several weeks or even for several months, for the most part, you're training them. They're getting used to the workplace. And you know, arguably you're taking a bit of a loss then, but you are recruiting talent, you are, you know, investing not only the money in paying them, but also in training, and you'll reap the benefits later on. There's a kind of a long-term business model to that, and I think it's no surprise that a lot of the firms with the best internship policies are well-established companies that have long-term business sense. The other side of the coin of internships as investment is the idea that it's the interns themselves, young people and their parents, who need to make the investment in the young person's future. And so by that logic, you should have to work unpaid, or you should be willing to work unpaid at least. And essentially because you still have all of your expenses, indeed you may have to live in a relatively expensive city like New York or Los Angeles, where internships tend to be concentrated. You're willing to, let's say for a summer, you know, spend $3,000-$4,000 essentially to work for somebody for free, with the idea that then, you know, maybe you'll get a job offer from them, or maybe you'll pile up enough of these things on your CV that one day you'll get a job offer and you will sort of enter into the paradise of the white collar economy and proceed to kind of high ranking jobs afterwards.
Yeah.
And that there is a pragmatic logic to that. Internships have become a kind of gateway into the white collar workforce. But in terms of Gary Becker and human capital theory, I mean, I think what's fascinating is that the popularization of that idea that we should all be sort of investing in people, in ourselves, or in young people, or whatever, in our children, that has become kind of the pervasive rhetoric surrounding internships. But obviously, I think that you know, the idea of companies investing in their employees is the relatively more kind of humane, enlightened approach, and that we're already asking young people to invest in themselves to such an extent with higher education and with, you know, deep student debt. I mean, that's an even sort of larger area of kind of investment that internships are now just kind of have become an extra burden. And it's particularly galling, the idea that you have to, you know, you have to work unpaid and pay to work, that there's an investment even at that stage.
But Ross, this enlightenment is something that's very important for businesses. I mean, after all, opening the gates of heaven, this sounds very similar to certain religious angles. This notion of working one's way to get something back later, well, we've had a perfectly wonderful system known as indentured servitude and slavery as well. I mean, you know, these things need to be rebranded, I think.
Well, I think, I mean, Gary Becker justified, he felt that, in fact, you know, indentured servitude, at least, was somewhat justified by human capital theory.
Yeah.
That, you know, and I think it's no surprise, there's a little bit of hyperbole to it, that people do, you know, compare interns to indentured servants. Obviously, the conditions of today's economy are such that interns sort of look like everybody else, and they kind of... They seem to be going about their lives, you know, without any problems, and to be acting with complete free will. But the reality is, when internships become a virtual requirement, the free will is not really there. This is a pressure that is being felt and that people are responding to. So, internships perhaps are kind of they might fit a kind of theological mode. In a sense, as you're saying, to enter into paradise.
Well, it's the ultimate extension.
You have to pay your
ultimate extension of Max Weber, I suppose. But I wanted to go back in time, a nostalgic sort of trip into pro-labor legislation, the Fair Labor Standards Act, which FDR called the most far-reaching, far-sighted program for the benefit of workers ever adopted in this or any other country when he signed it into law. Yet you have Walling versus Portland Terminal Company and present enforcement by the Wage and Hour Division, which has created an exemption for trainees and thus interns. So it is this exemption which seems to have permitted these unpaid internships to flow like water in the business world, like shots at mama. So what ultimately accounts for the manner in which American law has ignored establishing worker protection for interns? I mean, is it the murkiness of the court precedents after Walling, or is it more about the Department of Labor employees that are unavailable to enforce the FLSA?
Well, it's both. Yeah, to some extent, it's a matter of kind of labor law falling silent and much less and less attention to labor law. And on the other hand, it's also an issue of enforcement capacity at the Department of Labor. The Fair Labor Standards Act was such a sweeping piece of legislation, establishing the minimum wage, establishing the right to overtime, ending child labor. Right in the same period, you have the workers gaining the right to organize, you know, kind of unrestrainedly. You have this just, you know, incredible period in the 30s, a delirious period for organized labor where the tables are suddenly turned. Really, within a period of a few years, everything, almost everything that mainstream organized labor had been fighting for 4 or 5 decades sort of came to pass. And then really after World War II, I mean, there was an attempt to sort of keep labor peace through World War II to make sure that productivity for the war effort was ensured. But it was in the late 40s, that's also when you had the Taft-Hartley Act. It was in the late 40s that the kind of reaction began, and people started to sort of pick apart the Fair Labor Standards Act. So it's probably no surprise that this is the moment when Walling versus Portland Terminal comes along, creating just a little loophole, an exemption for trainees. The term intern is not used in the Supreme Court decision because, indeed, at that time, intern was really a very specialized term just applicable to the medical profession. But it opens up this exemption very, very quietly. And in what appears at the time to be a very innocent way, you're looking at trainees in a rail yard who really are, it seems, from having read the case, just being trained. I mean, just kind of shadowing and watching and learning from the experienced workmen in the rail yard. They're not performing meaningful labor. They're certainly not replacing regular employees. So it really is a trainee situation in a classical sense, and quite short term also. It was a very short period that was dealt with. But the Supreme Court lays out these 6 criteria, essentially, or writes a decision in which the 6 criteria are kind of embedded, which will determine whether somebody is a trainee, i.e. does not need to be paid during that period, or a worker, i.e. is still covered by the Fair Labor Standards Act. And then this, really only starting in the 1970s or so, when internships kind of come onto the Department of Labor's radar, this then is applied to interns because there's a freeze in terms of any new labor law, so nobody's creating new legislation about interns or anything like that. So they need to kind of look for a parallel case, something that they can apply. But starting in about the 1970s, incidentally, represents in some ways the kind of high watermark of the Department of Labor
yeah.
in terms of enforcement capacity, the number of personnel You know, if you go to their building in Washington, D.C., it was finished under Carter. And, you know, it's a large building. It's right near Capitol Hill. It's a very kind of confident expression of a department that is, you know, saw itself as having a high position in the federal bureaucracy. But since then, the number of personnel that they have for enforcing the Fair Labor Standards Act has gone down.
Yeah.
Even while the number of workplaces has increased by a huge number, even as the nature of work has changed greatly.
Whacked down under Republican presidential administrations, we might add.
Essentially, with each Republican administration, the Department of Labor has been thinned out more and more. Nor have, with some small exceptions, have Democratic administrations really built it back up.
To some
extent, they've kind of held the ground. But
yes. Too busy clinging to their territory to return to some of the pro-labor, progressive. I mean, what do you think accounts for just the wipeout of labor? I mean, we're talking about a situation where also unions have lost a lot of ground, and as we saw recently with the events in Wisconsin, they're still fighting a tremendous fight. You urge at the end of the book that, well, interns need to sort of take things back, but if there are loopholes in the FLSA, and if interns, who must remain anonymous, and in fact they protested anonymously, as you point out in the book, and if they don't really have these rights, I mean, you know, how can they be expected to fight back when, you know, labor itself as a whole, those who are employed as workers, can't really do much of it, or are faced with people like Walker.
I should say, at least about the FLSA, although the six criteria, the Walling versus Portland Terminal case provided a kind of loophole, at the same time, I do see it as to some extent protecting interns, you know, more than anything else. At least there is a kind of test like that, and at least those six criteria, compared to the kind of internship boom mentality now, where, you know, there's an idea that everybody can just work for free in any capacity, those criteria actually, you know, should and can be used to protect interns, especially one of those six that is often cited, saying that the trainee or intern in this case should not provide any immediate advantage to the employer during this kind of unpaid period of time. Now, in general, interns are required from day one to start providing immediate advantage, to start doing vital tasks in the workplace. So I do think these criteria, although this opened up a loophole and although companies are kind of hiding in there, it's up to interns themselves, it's up to colleges, it's up to the parents of interns, et cetera, to kind of to look at those six criteria and use them to defend themselves. In terms of the larger picture of organized labor, much wiser heads than I have speculated and talked about the overall arc, the overall trajectory of organized labor. But clearly it's connected to larger changes in the economy. And it's no surprise that the internship phenomenon is a white-collar phenomenon, and the white-collar world is one in which organized labor has had great difficulty, to a considerable extent, and also that internships are, in some ways, just one of a kind of cluster of types of what's called contingent labor, precarious forms of labor. Including temps, freelancers, the self-employed, perma-temps, perma-lancers. I mean, the number of terms out there itself is indicative of what has happened.
Permutations on perma alone.
Yes. There. I mean, the linguistic ingenuity is considerable, but what it gets at is the fact that the kind of standard conception of work that we have in our heads of somebody having kind of one career, maybe even at one or a few employers, 9 to 5, you know, with a pension and healthcare plan. I mean, that's a rarity now, and lots of people are kind of scrambling and kind of taking on all kinds of different roles. So interns fall into that, and again, that's an area where organized labor has had a lot of trouble, because organized labor focused its efforts and came of age. Also, in a period when standard employment was really standard employment as being kind of contradistinction to contingent labor that I'm talking about.
Yeah.
It came of age in the great period of standard labor, of standard forms of labor. So I think the labor movement has never really understood how to deal with people like interns, permalancers, freelancers, because they, you know, on the one hand, those people are sort of moving around so much, there's so much churn that it's very difficult to organize them. It's very difficult to kind of build up a consciousness in them about, you know, about the conditions of their overall labor. The human bonds are much weaker in some sense than they would be if you're talking about, you know, people working in one workplace, you know, becoming close friends or knowing each other very well over long periods of time, and also being part of a union and being able to take collective action. So the labor movement, I mean, in the internship phenomenon in some ways points up some of the central weaknesses of the labor movement, and some of the major reasons why the labor movement is flailing.
Let's shift to education. You tackle the notion of internships as they are applicable to educational institutions. One of your subjects, Jim, who's a sophomore, he uses his college connections to get an unpaid full-time internship at NBC. One of Jim's friends backs out of a living arrangement. Jim is forced to spend much of the summer. He's crashing on couches. He's taking out loans. And then NBC isn't satisfied with the low-quality journal entries that he turns in, and so he doesn't even get the college credit. He's expended his time, he's expended his money. It would seem that in Jim's case, that this was a situation in which there was not enough educational oversight. In an earlier chapter, you describe how educational institutions are outsourcing the oversight to other parties, especially in the case of Disney and their internships, which you tackle in the beginning part of the book. I'm wondering if this is a failure of oversight similar to the Department of Labor not having enough manpower, or if this is a situation in which many of the educational institutions have surrendered the terms so that they can't really protect their students, or they're basically, oh, well, let's go ahead and send these kids to Florida and we can't really look out for them. What of this? I mean, why do these things continue to happen without oversight?
Well, I should add first that in Jim's case, the diary entries were not approved of. I don't know if this was stated clearly enough in the book, but by his university in this particular case.
Oh, okay. I got the impression that it was NBC that did
so
that.
Maybe that wasn't clear. I'm not actually sure whether NBC looked at those, but in general, employers are often quite permissive. As long as you get the academic credit, which has to be issued by the school, employers are quite permissive about kind of how you get it or the standards for giving it. And there's all kinds of strange games with academic credit whereby it's essentially the employer requiring it of the student, sometimes saying, you know, advertising an internship saying, well, we don't pay, but we do offer academic credit. Well, of course, they don't offer it. Companies are not authorized to offer academic credit. They have nothing to do with that, really. What they mean is that they sort of force schools or they put the pressure on schools to kind of issue it and then provide some kind of oversight. But as you say, the oversight is very weak and very lacking.
Yeah.
Capacity is one problem. One issue that I talk about in the book and that I talked about in a New York Times op-ed as well is how 95% of schools, according to one survey, which looked at over 700 colleges and universities, allow unpaid internships, basically carte blanche, allow unpaid internships to be posted, you know, to be on campus, to be put up on kind of their career services websites, that sort of thing. And they claim that they simply, you know, their career offices, which are kind of in charge of internships, nominally at least, in some cases on college campuses, they claim they don't have the capacity to kind of review each one and say, oh, well, this is legal, this is not legal, or whatever. So they've just taken the approach, you can basically just post anything. I mean, you know, with very, very few exceptions, if somebody really sort of sketchy, very obviously sketchy comes along, but generally they just sort of click approve, 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 and they say, indeed, you know, most of these career services offices, it would be very rare to see, you know, even a double-digit number of staff. You know, in most cases, you're looking at 5 or 6 career counselors, you know, for large universities, you know, for large student bodies of, you know, major public and private schools. But that said, I think, you know, capacity is an excuse that they can hide behind, and it maybe explains an issue like the posting of unpaid and often illegal positions, but it doesn't explain some of the larger attitudes in the academy about the internship boom and the what I call the complicity of the academy. So it doesn't explain why schools charge First of all, require in many cases, require an internship, say, to complete a communications degree. And then even though you're doing almost everything off campus, maybe you're sending some diary entries to somebody who looks at them very briefly and evaluates them. But they're charging, you know, often the exact same amount. I mean, this can run up to $14,000 in a term.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to journalism school, let's say, and you've completed a, you know, four or five terms, and then your last term or your second to last term, they say, now you have to go do an internship, but you have to pay basically the same tuition you always pay. You may not do anything on campus. We're going to, you know, there'll be very minimal sort of oversight. Of course, you're going to be working unpaid as well in this internship usually. And that, you know, that raises questions. Is it because of the revenue that schools are doing this? Is it because they don't want to kind of, you know, weaken the currency of academic credit, or are they just blind to the issue? And that's a controversial question.
Were you able to take a look at any of the paperwork that some of these interns signed, and also perhaps what the institutions signed? I mean, it seems to me that if you're going to get underneath the hood, so to speak, you should probably find out, well, you know, what have the educational institutions surrendered to the corporations? What have the students surrendered to the internship program? Or is it a case, as you suggested before, where the students are, well, we've told the students that it's unpaid. They should have the minds to figure out what that means.
That's definitely the attitude.
Yeah,
the attitude is kind of sink or swim. You know, you should know what you're getting into.
Yeah.
I've seen some of the paperwork, though, on that floats around in different directions.
And
it's interesting. A lot of companies, that employers that have internship programs, or even just to take interns, have kind of internship agreements. Basically, you know, so you sign this thing that says, "I understand I'm not going to be paid. I understand, you know, that I've." It doesn't say I understand I'm going to have no rights, but that's kind of
non-disparagement clauses.
It has, some of them have stuff like that. I mean, it's not a very standardized sort of thing. My sense is that some of these are kind of thrown together. But the fact is, according to employment lawyers I talked to, you cannot sign away your right to be paid. You cannot sign away your right to the FLSA. So these are things essentially meant to kind of scare students, or to just kind of establish a kind of atmosphere about it. But they have no sort of legal meaning.
They don't sign an agreement where they limit their legal recourse to, say, a non-binding arbitration or anything like that, or...
I think that would be relatively rare.
Yeah.
I mean, most of the things are, these are relatively, you know, one or two page kinds of documents, which basically just, you know, are meant to spell out the overall understanding. But they have a kind of, even if they don't have legal force, they're phrased in a way that interns I spoke to, you know, felt that they had signed something away when they did this. Schools sometimes have these kind of agreements as well, or sometimes they give the agreement to both the intern and the employer, and everybody sort of has to sign it if academic credit might be involved. So there's all kinds of different practices out there, pretty sort of unstandardized at this point. But
there have been cases such as Lippold versus Dougal Color Projects, Lowry versus Clem, involving the sexual harassment of interns. You write that interns continue to lack the proper remedies for discrimination on the basis of race, color, national origin, religion, age, and disability. So you're saying that the Civil Rights Acts of 64, of 91, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, this does not apply to interns for similar reasons of how interns are defined under this trainee situation? I mean, I'm wondering if you can explain this statement, or is it because, really, an intern can't be legally identified as an employee?
Right. This is a complicated can of worms, and in some sense, you know, the law is nebulous or untested in some areas. But essentially, it's that unpaid interns are in the body of court precedent, pay is used as the kind of definitive marker of an employee versus somebody who is just not an employee, maybe a volunteer if it's a nonprofit, or, you know, where volunteering is possible, volunteering being illegal in the for-profit sector, it could be that the person is just considered by the law to be a bystander. If you're an unpaid intern at a company, according to the law, you are just somebody who happens to be sitting in the office, who happens to be there. You have no kind of standing in court. That's what the courts keep returning when unpaid interns There have been a number of cases, yeah, particularly around sexual harassment, which is not surprising considering the gender dynamics of internships, considering the unfortunate, the whole sort of some of the culture, the dark side of a kind of raunch culture surrounding interns in some cases.
But that's another story. Yeah.
The power dynamic, right, of the older employer and the very eager intern who's. But in any case, it turns on the notion of what is an employee, and the idea that an employee is somebody who is paid. And some people have tried to argue and say, well, interns are being paid in the currency of experience, or they're being, remuneration comes later in the form of a job or career advancement. But the fact is, all of these cases of interns suing and saying, unpaid interns suing and saying, I was sexually harassed, etc., the cases are not even heard by the courts. The courts say, you have no standing as an employee, therefore, all of these workplace protection things, some of the ones you mentioned, also lots of local legislation. I mean, you know, different cities and states all have different, you know, legislation about, you know, discrimination in the workplace or harassment in the workplace, these things. But none of that implies because these people are not employees.
Yeah.
So, it's not that interns have no recourse in that case. The first thing they could do, I mean, this is what I would advocate, is to prove I really was an employee, I should have been paid.
Yeah.
So what you go back to the 6-point test and you say, actually, this internship did not pass the 6-point test. Therefore, I was really an employee, not an intern. I should have been paid. So you establish employee status, and then you'll get your back wages as well.
Yeah.
But then you can also move on to the harassment claims. The second strategy, just speaking pragmatically for an intern, would be a tort case, essentially. You would just, you know, you wouldn't be doing it as an employee versus an employer, so you wouldn't have those particular protections. You would just be doing it as an individual versus another individual, or an individual versus some entity, a company.
Yeah.
But that's inadequate. I mean, the point of workplace protections, the point of this legislation is that there should be particular protections for the workplace space.
Yeah.
And for that environment, and for people with the status of employee vis-a-vis their employer. So the fact that none of that applies is, it's unfortunate. This is relatively little known about the internship phenomenon, that this is a very dark, sinister side of it. And, you know, there have been very few attempts to address it. I mean, there was one in Washington, D.C., to include the word intern in the human rights bill, which would kind of bring these protections in, but it's very rare this attempts to address this.
Why do you think there's such reticence to either define intern as a valid employee, or even these ongoing skirmishes against the 6-point criteria, which make it difficult for some interns to say, "Hey, look, I'm an employee too, therefore I have access to all this protection under the FLSA." I mean, you were saying earlier that, well, when they go ahead and sign up for a college internship program, you know, they're not exactly surrendering their FLSA rights. But on the other hand, it seems to me that, particularly with the sexual harassment, they are almost giving up their ability to sue, simply because they have spent so much time establishing that, yes, I was an employee too, or maybe there's some educational aspect to their vocation. What of this? I mean, why is there such a problem and also such a reluctance to say that these interns are employees too?
Well, I would give two answers. I mean, the more straightforward one is that, you know, it would open a can of worms for employers.
Yes.
To admit that interns were employees, then this line that they don't need to be paid would really no longer work. You would really have to treat them in a different way. You would probably have to do hiring in a different way. It would have to be much less, you know, everything would have to be much more above boards.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, that is anathema to many employers who are thrilled to have this kind of very, very flexible, very informal thing, a place where they can, you know, where connections are, you know, very easily used, where they can pull in, you know, their nephews and nieces and this sort of thing. And of course, not have to pay, and of course, hire and fire at will. You know, I mean, all of those things that make internships convenient and that have attracted so many employers to them for the wrong reasons. All of that would be threatened with the idea that interns are employees. The second thing, and maybe the more kind of complex sociological question, is that there's this feeling that interns are students, and that you can't be both a student and a worker. That, you know, the reality is that 80% of students, I'm getting this right, I think 80% of students work during college, in a real way. And a significant number, I have these numbers in the book, a significant number are working, you know, 30 hours a week.
Yeah.
There's a nice book on this. How universities work or some title like that. The fact is that there's a kind of feeling you're either a student or a worker, and, you know, ne'er the twain shall meet. And I think that's, you know, people want to sort of keep, if you keep them as students who are just, you know, moonlighting in the workplace or just doing something, liability and legal responsibility then remains with the school.
Mm-hmm.
And you feel justified in kind of in treating these people differently. But the reality is that they're being used as workers. They're doing the work of workers. That the internship explosion now, you know, has spread to postgraduates in huge numbers, to high school students, to people taking years off of school, to people in their 30s switching careers, all sorts of people who fall outside the idea of a student. So I think it's really kind of burst the bounds of the original conception. And you know, I think people need to recognize the complexity, the complex kind of intertwining of work and education. I mean, most Americans are already doing forms of work when they're 14, 15, 16 years old.
Yeah.
But we have this idea that you're a student all this time, and that's your primary identity, and that also keeps you from potentially organizing or potentially, you know, conceiving of yourself as a worker and thinking consciously about the conditions of your work. And not surprisingly, also our education system doesn't really teach much about this either.
Sure.
Because, you know, the whole kind of consciousness around work and laboring is weak.
Yeah. I want to go back to a question I don't think I got an answer when we were bringing up Gary Becker and Human Capital at the beginning, which is how paying workers and interns ties into economic cycles. You mentioned in the book that efforts to increase minimum wage during downtimes didn't have a significant effect on the economy. But now we're going from, say, not paying an intern at all, and also thus getting 12-hour shifts from the intern, versus paying them, and all of a sudden you see a great augmented salary. So a businessman will come at you and say, well, if I have to pay my interns, then I can't actually do my job. I have a business to keep afloat. You know, you have people in the book saying to you, interns have been great during the recession because now we have all this free labor who can help us with tasks because we can't afford to pay anybody. So what is your answer to a businessman who says that it's just economically unsustainable to pay the interns? Is there any historical precedents you can bring up similar to this minimum wage increase that demonstrate that there's a fallacious line of reasoning here? Or?
Well, the connection to economic cycles, to start
yes,
there, is an interesting one. I think it's something indicative about internships that, you know, in the last three or four decades, which is really the internship boom, the internship explosion that I talk about, it's just been a sort of rise and rise in terms of the quantity, in terms of the number of internships, in terms of the spread, you know, now globally into all kinds of different industries. It doesn't matter whether it's a boom time or a downtime. Now, arguably, the last 40 years or so has overall been a sort of flat time in some sense. So I don't know. There might be a counter argument there potentially if you're talking about macro cycles. But overall, the difference between the boom time and the downtime would be in the quality of the internships and in whether they're paid or unpaid.
Yeah.
It's clear that during downtimes now, and never more so clear as during this recent recession, that paid internships give way to unpaid internships.
Yeah.
That paid programs, you know, they look and it's an easy thing to cut. From talking to human resources professionals, I heard that in general, training is something that is often first on the chopping block when companies are looking to trim their budgets. So maybe it's no surprise that internships kind of come next.
And interns are essentially the new temps. I mean, I had a downturn myself in terms of freelancing work, and so I tried to get some temp work, and I was told that pretty much all temp work jobs had evaporated. So it has more of a cycle. When you know you can actually not pay someone, then why pay someone even temporarily?
Right. Yeah. I think it's really clear that interns are used to plug holes. They're used to plug operational holes. They're used when there's a hiring freeze. They're used when whenever kind of the wall has been hit in terms of labor costs supposedly for the employer. So that much is clear. In terms of the businessman who says, well, economically I can't pay these people. I can't do this. I've got a business to run. I would say that is short term. It's short term economic logic at best. And at worst is a kind of a dangerous move.
Well, elaborate on that. Short-term dangerous, what do you mean by that?
Short-term in the sense that by every measure, paid internship programs are better than unpaid. And so, cycling back to something we mentioned earlier, taking the long-term view, investing in people, investing in interns, investing in your newest employees in general is something that has been shown to pay great dividends. So to make it more kind of concrete, I mentioned one example in the book of an employer that saves substantial money through a paid internship program because they save on recruiting costs, because they basically it's used as a talent pipeline. Their success metric, if they can hire something like over 50% of their interns can be hired into full-time roles, they basically calculated that their cost, as opposed to just having to sort of go out and and recruit new full-time employees, if they could bring people in as interns are always going to be lower paid than regular employees. The costs are not that great. I mean, if you're just talking about minimum wage for interns, this is not something which is really going to affect the bottom line that much. I mean, truly, in a huge number of companies, you can have 1,000 interns for the price of one executive. I mean, that is the kind of spread we're looking at these days in terms of salaries. So, I mean, a company like this sees the economic sense of, I mean, they do hire people. So, of course, if you don't hire people at all, then maybe this sense would break down.
Yeah.
But there's a huge difference between the company which just uses interns on a short-term basis, unpaid. They have access to a narrower applicant pool for their internships. They don't have access to the widest array of talent. A number of people I talked to reported, when they're going from paid to unpaid or unpaid to paid, the quality changes, the quality of the people you get changes a great deal, because if you have a paid internship program, just about anybody can apply. I mean, relatively speaking, if you advertise it, transparently, if you put it out there kind of like a job more or less, you're going to have access to a really broad, talented pool of people.
Well, I was going to say that just having a short-term viewpoint isn't enough. I mean, I want to give you a very good example. It's right on the cover of your book. You have Benjamin Kunkel. He is one of the editors of N Plus One. He's blurbed this book, and he's called it a fascinating and overdue expose. But N Plus One, they, by the way, have interns who are not paid, who are involved, according to the N Plus One website, of printing, distribution, publicity, subscription, web administration, transcription, carrying boxes, and bartending. So, in other words, it doesn't sound all that different from, say, the Disney College program or even a government internship, which we haven't even talked about that. So there's even the alleged Twitter feed of the N plus one interns, and I'm not sure if it's a joke or if it's actually them. But if Kunkel can commend your book and call it a muckraking expose while simultaneously sort of turning a blind eye to the fact that, well, he's not going to be able to keep N plus one going without his interns, isn't there a certain hypocrisy in this? I mean, if middle class society exploits interns, I mean, what hope is there for changing people's minds? Will they ever even see beyond the short term? I mean, I agree with you that they probably should, but the reality is, and Kunkel, liberal-minded gent, well, Look at what he's doing.
Mm. The publishing industry and is one of the worst. It's one of the worst offenders.
Yeah.
The publisher of this book, Verso, has announced that, you know, much to my, you know, making me very, very happy. I mean, that they have a, you know, a well-paid, well-structured program. And I know they're trying to kind of spread that model in the world of independent, even left-wing publishing. But truly, this has been such an unpoliticized issue,
yeah,
that it doesn't rise to the level of consciousness. All kinds of people who see themselves as championing workers' rights, or they see themselves as liberal, completely ignore this issue, or they figure, oh, well, these interns are rich kids, so they can afford it. It's not a big deal if we don't pay them. Well, that's an interesting statement. But first of all, I would uphold the right of everybody should be paid for labor, no matter what their background. And so I think, you know, to introduce a double standard is actually a dangerous idea, even though people informally air that kind of opinion all the time. But second of all, if indeed they are kids, you know, born with a silver spoon in their mouth, the question is why? Well, or why are those your interns? Well, because they're the only ones who can afford to work for the non-pay that you're offering. So, you know, I think that, you know, there probably are some small organizations getting off the ground that, you know, that would have a great, you know, that would have trouble surviving if they didn't have interns. But in most cases, I think, you know, whether it's a small liberal magazine in Brooklyn or a startup in, you know, in the Midwest or whatever it is, you know, they use interns to kind of extend what they can do, to build up their capacity, to try to do more. They use it because they can, because it's there, and they haven't questioned it. And one thing I'm hoping to do with the book is politicize it such that, you know, anybody who wants to get up on soapboxes and say, you know, this or that is liberal, we should fight for workers, protect workers, and social mobility and social justice, and talk about these kinds of things, will also look at their own workplace practices. But this is, you know, but this is a much larger issue of people practicing what they preach, right? I mean,
yes.
You know, in terms of work, in terms of labor, it's just, you know, there's so often a disconnect. Look at college campuses, you know, supposed hotbeds of liberalism. You walk into the lecture halls and you have Marxist professors elaborating on this or that. You know, until a few years ago, you know, and this has only been in a limited kind of area, you know, the people you had actually picking up the trash and like keeping campus running, you know, cooking the food, etc., you know, there was often very little connection between those big picture ideologies which are going on in the classroom and the treatment of those workers.
Yeah.
I mean, the living wage movement on some campuses tried to rectify that and made a connection. But, you know, often you had people on those campuses, you know, theorizing about things that were happening, you know, in China or, you know, in around the world or whatever, but not noticing the actual, you know, realities of work on their own campus. So.
Yeah. Well, if the interns, I mean, not only are they invisible to even the liberal-minded, but they also are something that people don't want to see. I mean, you have people who are the working poor who are invisible. I mean, what is the solution to making them more visible? I mean, they are people too. They have debts they must pay. On the other hand, you also bring up apprenticeships in this book, but even electrician Don Davis tells you that apprenticeships remain the best-kept secret. The interesting thing about apprenticeships is that they do pay an hourly wage. Some of them provide health care, pension plans, daycare, and the like. Is it really a matter of trying to make people more aware of something that's secret? And if people, and if businesses become more aware of, say, something like apprenticeships, well, they may very well declare war upon them in the same way that they keep the concept of an intern invisible within their own fold. So do we start replacing internships with apprenticeships, not necessarily just with books, but with people raising pitchforks in the streets?
Well, I think it's amazing the extent to which apprenticeships, you know, these are trade apprenticeships, blue-collar apprenticeships, are sort of invisible to people who are not in that world, who are not in the trades, especially in construction, which accounts for,
yeah,
generally about 60% of all apprentices are engaged in construction overall. So it's, you know, it's one of those things, it, you know, unfortunately, yeah, if you raised more awareness about apprenticeships, it's possible that there could be more of an attack on them. That there is legislation relating to it. The Fitzgerald Act, which established a kind of registered apprenticeship program, which set standards that I see as a kind of model, again, not incidentally in the 1930s, as part of all that, the sort of golden age of labor legislation. I think that the reason that apprenticeships have kind of remained as they are is because these are generally heavily unionized fields where there are certain standards about what work should look like, what a humane experience is like, and because they work in terms of a longer term mentality. It's something that's been going on for 70 years. And from the employer's point of view, I mean, a lot of employers, you know, welcome apprenticeships, and in fact, there's often the battle often is between kind of the union and the employer over overuse of apprentices by the employer. Because relatively, even though apprentices are being well paid and have a lot of benefits, as you say, relatively they're still cheaper than using kind of a full-time, you know, or a sort of, you know, post-apprentice union member worker, which to me is indicative of the fact that, you know, internships would survive quite well even if there was more regulation, because again, interns will still represent quite a cheap, reasonable solution for businesses, you know, to sort of bring on new workers and to accomplish certain work. So what I'm just saying is that, you know, even if they have to pay minimum wage, there's, you know, will be quite a lot of scope for internships. In terms of raising pitchforks in the streets, I think apprenticeships are a real model for internships to look to, but it would be a huge, you know, it's a huge hurdle to kind of bring a blue collar practice into the white collar workforce in an era when the white collar workforce is seen as kind of the norm and the vanguard and the, you know, setting the standard. And it was shocking to me, and I think it's shocking to a lot of people, that actually here's something that the blue collar world is doing so much better.
Yeah.
So much better. Training and bringing in young people and kind of having a humane sort of program. Invisibility, yeah, I think there's an invisibility about labor kind of more generally. I mean, I think there, interns are not invisible in the same kind of way that apprentices or the working poor are. They're featured in pop culture. Everybody sort of sees them around. It's known, you know, who's the intern, you know. They're often kind of, it's often very small little markers. They might be, you know, a little bit fresh-faced. They might wear a certain kind of badge. Like in Washington, D.C., there's a particular intern badge everybody knows on Capitol Hill. And people like to talk about interns, and it's funny and so on.
But they're also the subject of ridicule, too.
But there are, yeah, but often that visibility is that they're a kind of laughing stock and that they're like figures of fun. But I think, you know, people do look at interns and they see, you know, middle class kids, they see people who might become them, people they might work with later on. So there's an atmosphere of civility, and there's not the kind of, you know, there's not the class distance often that there is with the working poor, with blue collar workers, where there's this feeling of kind of, oh, that's almost like the other, that's a different somebody else. That in itself is kind of represents an interesting problem. The class dynamics of internships are complicated for that reason.
But you're dealing also with a certain dichotomy of perception. Wisconsin, people are really supporting the unions there. Interns, not so much, because of this idea that, well, they knew what they were getting into. It's fascinating to me that there would actually be a strange inverted disparity with the unpaid white-collar worker versus the paid blue-collar worker, or the paid, you know, social services worker and the likes. Do you think that's part of the problem too? I mean, is there any way that you could change that cultural perception, especially since you have it supported not just by media reinforcement, but also by the fact that the U.S. government alone uses a lot of interns in various capacities, and it's highly competitive, as for the reasons we've said earlier as well.
Well, I think it's hard to know what the degree of public support for interns is. As far as I know, the public hasn't, in the UK, the public has been polled on the issue, and there's a very strong feeling that interns should be paid, and you know, a very strong majority feels that what goes on now is wrong. In the US, it's hard to know, but I suspect you would still see most people thinking, interns should be paid. But the feelings, you know, there are complex feelings there, it's true. And I think part of it is because there's this, as you say, a strange dichotomy. Interns are both privileged and exploited at the same time.
Yeah.
They're privileged in the sense that they do have access to this experience that might put them over the top, that they can get into the white-collar workforce. They're not in as bad a situation, arguably, as people who simply cannot pay to play and will never break into the white-collar workforce, because in the blue-collar world, I mean, it's not an expanding world for the most part, as manufacturing continues to kind of bleed away and you know, feel in areas like construction where the apprentices are extremely vulnerable in economic downturns, especially this most recent one. You know, people see the white-collar world, that winner-take-all white-collar world, as that is where you access influence. That's where the big money is.
Yes.
And so to get a shot at that, at least, that is the privilege of the intern, the person who has the family money or their own money or whatever to pay for the experience or to work unpaid. So I think people see that. And then the other element is that, you know, interns are in many, many cases, this is hard to bring out, but people feel it. Our interns are replacing full-time workers or displacing them or being used to fill the breach. So inevitably the full-time workers feel some degree of resentment about these kids who are sort of taking their place. And they see, you know, the world belonging to the young and, you know, the cult of youth, and all these things play into a view that, you know, that actually interns are, you know, are rich kids and whatever. And but in general, people are not thinking systemically about the issue. And that's what I really would like to see come out of the book. I want people to see this sprawling kind of, not centralized, not standardized, but kind of an internship system, a whole kind of gestalt, which is you know, at large in our society. And, you know, and to think about it and to then, you know, think rationally about how with public policy and with individual decisions, we might change how things work. So that to me would be the goal, rather than, you know, simply just, you know, pity the intern.
Yeah.
There are lots of horrible stories out there, and they're people worth pitying and helping. But the larger issues are systemic, and it also has to do with people who simply can't afford to do internships at all. That's a whole other piece of the story, which usually doesn't percolate up to consciousness, at least in the U.S., or make it into the media.
One last question. You note in the notes that you contacted a good chunk of the people in this, the interns and the like, through email and through phone. I'm curious, largely because some of the people on the phone told you that they couldn't name their names and they couldn't name the companies they work for. It would seem to me very difficult to corroborate their internships with the appropriate companies. I mean, to what degree did you do that? I mean, since we are talking about a sector of the labor population that is invisible, it would seem to me that, you know, ensuring that they were telling the right stories, that they weren't plants, that they weren't phonies. I mean, what did you do to ensure that they actually were interns?
Well, I have to say, first of all, that, people were very reluctant to kind of divulge specific information, and that went for people I know quite well or that I've known for several years, who I met in person and you know, who I had a strong relationship of trust, just as much as with people that I, you know, haven't met in person and spoke to on the phone. So that there was, you know, from a significant enough number of people, a real reluctance around these things, because with internships, often all that you have at the end of it, you haven't gotten a paycheck or anything like that, you haven't gotten training. You've just got a reference. You've just got sort of, you know, perception of the employer that you're a good kid that they'll recommend in the future. So people were very careful.
But people you talked on the phone, I mean, how did you know that they were who they said they were?
Yeah, I generally tried to corroborate their claims with, you know, at least that the company had an internship program that basically fit this model. Given the constraints of anonymity, I could not go to these companies and say, did Jimmy X do an internship at your company, because that would give up their anonymity. But in general, I mean, I worked with a convenience sample of people, you know, friends of friends or friends of friends, you know, of friends. But my main feeling was that people didn't have a motive. I mean, these were not people reaching out to me generally. This is me reaching out to people. People didn't have a motive to lie or to make up stories.
People always have motives to lie. I mean, people are engaged in all sorts of chicanery, which is why, especially for a sensitive issue like this, you have to make sure they are who they say they are. I mean, I know you're Ross Perlin because I'm sitting with you, you know, we're here in the flesh, right. So to speak, you know, I can, you know, I've got pictures of you somewhere. Right. I know you've authored this book for the most part. I can, if not, I can contact Verso and you know, get drafts or something. You know,
this might have all come from previous Bat Segundo programs.
Yeah, exactly, or something. Or maybe you've ghostwritten. I don't know. But see, the point is that I actually have a verifiable essence in you here right now. And so, if I'm doing a book on a very loaded topic, I would, you know, make great strides to make sure these people are absolutely who the hell they say they are. And so I'm wondering if you could entirely trust their statements.
There's always a little bit of leap of faith in journalism in doing these interviews. You know, the ultimate, if somebody really wanted to obscure their identity and really wanted to put one over on me, the book doesn't rely deeply on the story of any one individual. And there were hundreds of interviews kind of went into the background noise. I mean, several dozen are foregrounded, but and of those, might a few have come from people who, there were definitely people who I know kind of misremembered things or only remembered things kind of vaguely. I tried to talk to people, not just to speak to one person at a given internship program, but also ask them for the name of a fellow intern. And speak to that person. Now, could that person also have been a plant? Possible. Or myself go find a person who did the internship more recently or in a different year and see, did the experiences more or less match up, or was this an outlier?
But for stories of tremendous abuse, were you able to corroborate any of those with, like, say, other people who happened to work in the places or anything like that? I mean, what did you do for that?
I mean, that would be... The means that I said of kind of contacting other interns at the same workplace, that was generally the method, and in a few cases trying to talk to the employer contacting the employer without revealing the name of the intern in question and explaining the relatively generic situation and saying, you know, was this or could this not be the case, and making sure they said ultimately yes, you know, even if they weren't happy to say so. So there were some cases like that, but there are some stories in the book that essentially, you know, it's somebody who, you know, I didn't ultimately go to, you know, the full length of research to find out. Is this, you know, does this jive with all the other interns' experiences? Yeah. Is this a complete outlier? Is this person, you know, a trustworthy person? In some cases, those judgments were beyond me to make.
So you're saying basically that a leap of faith in journalism is certainly applicable to a very invisible sector of the labor population, that you have to sort of get almost a fingerprint rather than the complete picture. And until interns actually have more of a public face, we really won't know the full extent of abuses.
The book is impressionistic, absolutely.
Yeah.
The statistics used, I try to kind of emphasize a number of times, not my own statistics because that wasn't part of my project, but they're not the gold standard. They don't meet the gold standard of Bureau of Labor Statistics figures according to an established definition. One thing I struggled with is, you know, even what counts as an intern, you know, when that term is used, or should I include people where that term itself wasn't used, but the situation really resembles the kind of archetypal internship. So yes, this is a first shot shot at the question. It's impressionistic. It's meant to just kind of provide a broad picture of all of the kinds of things that go on under this heading in the internship economy.
Like all journalism, it's the first draft of history.
Yes, absolutely, the first draft. But I hope to see more final drafts from others. you know, in different places.
Yeah. Well, Ross, thanks so much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you.
All right.
All those people that you know, all those people that you know, all those people that you know, floating in the river, all lost. I can buy myself a reason, I can sell myself a job.